Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So my friends, let's roll up our sleeves. 59 days till election start. Let's stand up for prosperity. Let's stand up for security. Let's stand up for democracy. And above all, my friends, let's stand up for Europe.
That was Ursula von der Leyen, who's hoping to secure a second term as Commission President, and who officially kicked off her campaign in Athens last week. What? You missed her rousing speech in Greece? Well, you weren't the only one. Von der Leyen's newly formed campaign team didn't even bother to notify us, the journalists. We covered it anyway. And we'll get into that in today's episode. But with less than 2 months to go before Europeans cast their votes, it's hard not to be puzzled by the campaign's, well, sluggishness. Where are the debates? The rallies? The sniping? Nicola Schmidt, the other lead candidate running for the European Socialists, is trying a little harder than von der Leyen. He's out and about. But do people notice? I'm Sarah Wheaton, host of EU Confidential. In this episode, we're checking in on the state of this slow-paced race. Von der Leyen might not be on offense, but she's sure on the defensive. Remember Pfizergate? That's only getting worse for her. And now there's a new gate swinging in her face. With my Politico colleagues, we'll start by looking at black clouds hanging over the Commission president. You don't want to miss it. We also have a panel, and trust me, I say this with love, of keen election geeks. My colleagues Eddie Wax and Clotilde Goujard, and a communication strategist Matteo Albania. They will help us make sense of the campaign so far and unpack how the campaign is unfolding online, considering yucky behavior like disinformation, AI-generated deepfakes, and micro-targeting. That discussion is coming up later. First up, though, let's welcome Elisa Braun, our Brussels correspondent, and Nick Vinneker, Politico's editor-at-large. Nick, let's start with you. A week ago, you had a great headline on Playbook, Knives Out for von der Leyen. Her campaign officially started. She did her first campaign event in Athens. How'd that go?
Well, it's hard for me to say because we didn't get advance notice of it, and it was a bit of a surprise. I think it was underwhelming as an official campaign launch for such an important position, and that in itself is very telling, that this speech, this moment was sort of so muted and not a big media event. And it tells us day after day that von der Leyen is campaigning, but does not really want to campaign in a classical sense, a politician running for office. It's not quite that.
Usually, in my experience of covering campaigns, I'm constantly hearing from everybody from a top spokesman to interns, making sure I know about at least all of their talking points. As you said, the press were not told about this event. Does von der Leyen have that sort of infrastructure?
No. So, I mean, she was officially nominated by the EPP on March 7th to be the lead candidate, a sort of very long month dragged by before they unveiled her campaign team, which is composed of two people, her chief aide in the commission, Bjørn Seibert, and another gentleman who's just been brought in as her campaign spokesman. But neither of these people have offered any briefings. Basically, there isn't much campaign infrastructure. There's a Twitter account that was created on March 7th, which has fewer followers than the "This is fake von der Leyen" account on Twitter. They have not invested this campaign. They may not ever want this to be a real campaign.
All right. Well, so she doesn't really have a strong defense or a strong offense, it sounds like right now. Elisa, over to you. You and our colleague Carlo Martuselli have been covering the developments in Pfizergate. That's also sometimes known as DeleteGate. She supposedly was texting with the CEO of Pfizer during the vaccine procurement negotiations. She won't show us the texts. What's the latest?
I've also heard SMSgate, by the way. So the news is that we've heard from a Belgian court that the European Public Prosecutor's Office had taken over the case of a Belgian lobbyist, Frédéric Baldon, who had filed a complaint directly against von der Leyen. So in short, that means that now the European Prosecutor's Office is investigating the fact that she allegedly deleted public documents related to this massive contracts with Pfizer. And although the EPO, as we call it, hasn't commented on the case, we know for a fact that it's a big investigation. It has been going on for at least 2 years, and now that they are specifically going after her. And since then, Baldon has been joined by two member states in his complaint. Hungary, which is, as you know, always fighting with the Commission over rule of law concerns, and Poland. So my colleague Carlo Marticelli and I reached out to these two countries, and Poland told us that they were in the process of withdrawing their complaint since Poland has a new prime minister that is more commission friendly. I would say that it's a very fascinating case because it shows that when there are member states joining, it adds weight to the procedure, and it's not a good look. Even though one of the two countries is withdrawing its complaint, it doesn't necessarily mean that the case stops and that the complaints that Poland was filing are completely withdrawn.
This investigation that you've been talking about by the Belgians and the European public prosecutor, is that the only case floating around with Pfizergate?
No. So the main one, and actually one of the most interesting one, I would say, is the one in front of the EU Stop Court in Luxembourg, because the New York Times filed a complaint to annul the decision from the commission not to release the text. If you managed to understood that, congratulations. But basically they are opposing the commission's lack of transparency. And should the top court approve the New York Times request, that would mean a lot for all the politicians' communications, because that would mean that in some instances they should keep their texts for us to read them.
Well, as a journalist, I certainly support that. And what has von der Leyen said, if anything?
Well, you tell me, Sarah, because you're the latest person who asked her directly the question about Pfizergate.
Indeed, I did have a chance to ask her when she first announced her candidacy in Bucharest.
President von der Leyen, the New York Times is suing for access to your texts with Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla. Are you concerned about the outcome of that lawsuit? Can you tell us about that exchange? And do you think political transparency and integrity are legitimate issues in your campaign for a new term? Thank you.
And well, I think we have time to play the entirety of her remarks.
Everything necessary about that has been said and exchanged. And we will wait for the results.
So as she said, we await the result. Do we have a sense of timing? Are we going to likely know the results of either of these cases before the June elections?
So it's very unlikely that we'll get the results from the European Public Prosecutor's investigation before the summer. It takes a long time. And when it comes to the one at the top court, the problem is that this Belgian lobbyist also wanted to join the New York Times case. So it sort of delayed the whole procedure and the court refused it. So they appealed the decision and now they are another 6 months delay. So it's very unlikely that it will happen before the election.
Okay, well, Nick, back over to you. We've got Pfizergate. We've also got now Peepergate. Who is the peeper in Peepergate?
The peeper in Peepergate sorry, trying not to laugh, but is Markus Pieper, who is a German member of European Parliament, who belongs to the CDU, German Conservative Party, which happens to be the party of Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the Commission.
And he has, at least as far as Ursula von der Leyen would like to see, a new job coming up.
Right. He's recently been named the SME envoy of the European Union, envoy for small and medium-sized enterprises, for which he'll be generously paid about 15,000 euros a month after tax. And he was named to this position by von der Leyen's office.
So what's the problem?
The problem, according to the other candidates and according to four European commissioners, is that there were other candidates who were better qualified, allegedly, who scored higher on the placement tests and who also happened to be women. And, you know, commission has guidelines for gender parity in sort of senior management roles. And so people have been asking, why did you choose this person who is a political ally over these other candidates who appeared to be better qualified for it?
And what is the answer that we're hearing from the commission to that question?
So the commission has responded to this letter signed by these four commissioners and said, in fact, all our procedures were respected. We made an evaluation based on the merit that sort of takes other criteria into account, and we essentially stand by our decision to name him and admit nothing. But that's not the end of the story, because the commissioners have already responded, the critical commissioners, and said, you have failed in a duty of collegiality or of benevolence in sort of information with the rest of the commission. And the European Parliament is piling on more pressure, voting on a resolution which calls on von der Leyen to rescind the job offer to Markus Pieper. So going even further than the commissioners did in their letter. And of course, you have the whole community of advocacy groups, Transparency International, Corporate Europe Observatory, that are asking questions about the nomination process, but also how the job role was created in the first place. It was originally conceived as an unpaid position created in 2021. They named a person, and that person was sort of lobbied against, including by Markus Pieper, and they revised the role, increased the scope, made it a high-paying job in the commission. And then just in the weeks ahead of von der Leyen getting the nod from the CDU, he was named for this position. So,
I mean, there are a lot of fancy jobs in the commission. Why are people freaking out about this one thing?
It's a good question. They're freaking out because we are right before an election. And von der Leyen has been chosen as the lead candidate of the EPP and is widely expected to win support from heads of state and parliament for a second term. But she now faces this unprecedented rebellion from four senior commissioners. These are not minor commissioners from small countries. It's Thierry Breton from France, Paolo Gentiloni from Italy, Nicolas Schmidt from Luxembourg, but who's also the lead candidate for the center-left camp, and Josep Borrell of Spain, who is the EU's top envoy. And these people are openly questioning their boss within the commission, a place that does not do kind of bare-knuckled politics. I find that remarkable. To me, it's a mixing of sort of campaign politics and just sort of institutional procedure. And it's something that makes the bubble EU bureaucrats uncomfortable, this sort of eruption, this mixing of politics and institutional affairs.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the most collegial. And we're in our next panel going to get into the von der Leyen versus Schmidt dynamic. But another commissioner that you mentioned who's on that list of critics is Thierry Breton, the single market commissioner. Elisa, back over to you. So Breton first sort of made the bubble uncomfortable with a tweet right after von der Leyen was first formally nominated, where he pointed out that even among her own party, when she was the only candidate, her nomination as the EPP lead candidate didn't really win as strong majority as we might think. And he was really criticized for sending out that tweet. But he had a response this week.
Yeah. So One thing that we should maybe tell was that when he published that tweet, that came out of the blue, and suddenly all our sources in Paris reached out to us, and the team in Paris also got a lot of feedback from the Élysée, who said that they were furious about this tweet, that Thierry Breton should never have said this. And weirdly, although this was confirmed by several sources, this week Thierry Breton had a very nice profile in French media Libération, where he said that Macron loved his tweet, thus responding to the haters who may have thought that he was doing that solo. But many wonder if it's, again, another trick of Thierry Breton, another provocation. I mean, he sort of plays around this kind of personage. But that's also why I think that people talk about it. Because as you said, Sarah, this EU bubble is quite uncomfortable with people who are too political. And Thierry Breton is definitely trying to use that card. And so far, it's going well for him. He's still a major hit in the media every time he says something against von der Leyen. And also the fact is that since his tweet came out, people have started talking, even within his Renew camp. And Nick, that's what you wrote in your playbook. But many people have started criticizing von der Leyen openly, even from Renew.
Indeed, yeah. We heard the lead candidate from Renew, Valérie Ayer, said, you know, we cannot promise that Renew will be backing von der Leyen in the European Parliament. And that was a really useful reminder that there are sort of three different elections going on. We have the one in June that is the people. And then there are two others. Nick, can you help unpack this a little bit? Like, do you think the real people who will be going to the polls from June 6th to 9th are paying any attention to Peepergate or Pfizergate or Breton's catty comments?
So this isn't a perfect focus group, but I just met with a group of Czech journalists and they brought up Pfizergate. And so they had heard of that. They're not average people, granted, but they had not yet heard about Peepergate. So I think that these things actually worm their way into, you know, they're on social media, they're out there. And to say, well, people simply don't care about this. Well, I think that's actually being naive. And I think there's probably what I find very surprising was seeing actually, for example, in someone like Marine Le Pen, how much importance she gives to Ursula von der Leyen in her campaigning. She's named von der Leyen as her target, as her kind of adversary, political adversary. And so that helps to make von der Leyen a household name. And of course, everything, all the baggage that's attached to her also finds its way into the national media. They won't pay as much attention, spend as much time, but these things do percolate. Yeah.
And we should make extra clear, Marine Le Pen is not running to replace von der Leyen, but she's nonetheless using her as sort of the boogeyman.
Absolutely.
And so regardless of whether, you know, these discussions have an impact on the general public at the ballot box, is there an argument that what happens in the bubble does actually matter for von der Leyen and her future?
Really concretely, like the big challenge, first hurdle she needs to get is to get support from heads of state in council to confirm her for a second term. When it comes down to that day and to get at least 15 heads of state to support her, somebody could say, well, I'm sorry, this is a person who is currently facing a criminal probe over this. And for that reason, either I'm going to extract a higher price for my vote, or I simply won't support. And then, you know, the whole narrative could be thrown up in the air and somebody else could be put forward.
Yeah, and the problem with this kind of trouble is that when it rains, it pours. And Ursula von der Leyen, when she's appearing weak or at least criticized, attacked on many fronts, that opens the way for other people, as you said, Nick, to negotiate more. And yeah, the outcome then becomes more tricky.
So we have these three votes, essentially, the vote of the people in June, the vote of the council, and then the vote of the European Parliament, where these factors can also, if somebody's really mad about Peepergate or any other gate, they can take their revenge. So I think there is a little bit of drama in this election. That's my biased journalist conclusion.
Absolutely.
Thanks to my colleagues Elisa Braun and Nick Vinegar. We know you're going to be watching for that drama until we know the election results. After the break, we'll have a strategy session. The pace of the campaign, the online code of conduct for political parties, and pink jackets. Stay with us.
Hey.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm here in the studio with my colleagues Eddie Wax and Clotilde Gujard.
Hi.
Hi.
And also joining me in the studio is Matteo Albania. He's the director of communications at Musk Consulting. Thanks for being here, Matteo.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for inviting me.
So, Eddie, before the break, we were talking about how the knives are out for Ursula von der Leyen. So that must mean her campaign's kicking into high gear to kind of fight back against this, right?
Not really. I think it's in her best interest to keep the campaign as kind of low profile as possible. I think what's most important to her is that she is still the president of the European Commission. She hasn't stepped back from that role. And I think she still is widely considered to be the front runner for this job. So I think as a campaigner, I think probably the people close to her are advising her, at least that's what it looks like from our side, to campaign as little as possible. She was in Greece last weekend with the New Democracy Party, member of the EPP, her political family. She gave a speech which didn't make any news, really.
My dear friends.
It used the word friends 11 times.
My friends, my dear friends, my dear friends. So my friends. Let's roll up.
And, you know, she pretty much said the same thing that she said, you know, exactly a month before, which is when she actually became the candidate, where she kind of attacked the far right. And it was kind of very comfortable territory for her.
My friends, there's a lot at stake in the upcoming elections, in the days, weeks and months ahead.
She spent a month basically not campaigning. She had been designated as the candidate in Romania back in March. We were both there. We did a podcast from there. But, you know, there was basically silence since then. She didn't appoint a campaign team until a few days ago. Everything shows that from her point of view, she is the candidate. She will do some level of campaigning, but she's not going to throw herself into this.
Can you paint us a picture? What does that look like, especially maybe compared to the socialist lead candidate, Nicolas Schmidt?
Yeah, so Nicolas Schmidt has been very active. You know, he has been carrying on as also in his role as the European Commissioner for Jobs, but he has been pretty much traveling all around Europe. He was recently in Romania himself, where he was visiting a textile factory, and he's been doing all these sorts of, you know, media friendly appearances, giving lots of speeches, basically really sort of networking. And I think the differences in their campaigns can be seen pretty clearly. I mean, the EPP, for example, just uploaded 16 portrait photographs of von der Leyen wearing different shades of print jackets to the EPP's website. And, you know, you go on the Party of European Socialists website and you see Schmidt, you know, talking to lots of young people, giving lots of speeches.
Comrades, we have a project of hope, of progress, of justice and shared prosperity. I'm counting on your support and you can count on mine.
But the irony, of course, is that while von der Leyen doesn't campaign, and he does, frankly speaking, von der Leyen is still way out ahead of him in terms of being able to lead the commission again.
And Clotilde, you are a tech reporter here. You, speaking of kind of the online campaign, you've been following some law changes that affect the way parties can campaign at the European level. Can you walk us through a couple of the things that are relevant here?
Sure. During the last mandate in the last few years, there have been a lot of different new tech laws that were adopted, and this is having an impact, as you were saying, on the online campaigning. I think the onus here is more on the online platform themselves, at times more than on the political parties. The political parties still have to abide by Europe's most famous tech law, the GDPR, its privacy law that restricts the way political parties can use people's personal data to target them, let's say, with online advertisement or send them personalized communications. This time around, though, the new laws that we have, for example, is the Digital Services Act. That's a new law that was adopted and that's just come into force. And major social media, let's say TikTok, but also Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, have to make sure that they're limiting anything that could impact the elections. That's very broad. So in practice, it means, for example, any political ad has to be very clearly labeled. People have to know who paid for it, where it's coming from, how long it's running, how many people it has reached. And there are new rules, like, for example, anyone, any company, but also in this specific case, political parties cannot target people based on sensitive data. So let's say your sexuality, you cannot do that any longer, you know, target specifically a message for, let's say, the gay community and put it on Facebook. So there are these new rules. But again, like I was saying, it's more up to the platforms like, let's say, Google and Facebook to make sure that they're abiding and checking that all of the actors around are respecting them.
So that's really interesting. There was a different piece of legislation that also was just adopted that does make it a little easier for the European parties to buy political ads online. Can you tell us briefly about that?
That's a political advertising regulation, yet another European regulation for tech. This one is a bit of a little brother sister to the big Digital Services Act, the DSA that I was mentioning before. And the idea is to introduce more specific rules for political advertising. The thing is, it was recently adopted, so many of these rules won't be enforced for this specific elections in June. But one of the rules that will apply is the possibility for European political parties, institutions as well, to advertise online across borders, which was not possible in the previous election.
Great, thank you. And so, Matteo, let me bring that to you, because now you're in the private sector, but during the 2019 campaign, you were doing this type of communication strategy for the European People's Party. And basically, what Clotilde is saying is that only just now are these European parties that are supposed to talk to all of Europe able to buy ads in all of Europe. I mean, is that really what was going on when you were working for the European People's Party, Matteo?
Weirdly enough, yes, in the sense that we were allowed to buy ads only in the country where we were registered, and that was Belgium. And that meant we could only be visible and campaign to our audience in Belgium. But of course, we had followers from all over Europe. We wanted to reach Germany, we wanted to reach Italy, Greece, France, and so forth. So now, with this new regulation coming in, a European political party can run ads in Europe, which is its constituency, its natural constituency. So what was odd was before that a European political party could only campaign in Belgium, which is, of course, not its natural constituency, but just the place where they are registered from a legal point of view.
The bubble talking to the bubble.
Exactly. It comes down also about the political actors. As Eddie was saying, from von der Leyen, we haven't seen much of a campaign so far. Schmidt is a bit more active. Back in 2019, Manfred Weber was running already as of November when he was elected. So he had 8 months of campaign. He was touring around Europe. He did a listening tour. He visited all the 27 member states. It was a real true pan-European campaign. Now I'm afraid that everyone is waiting for the 10th of June for the results, and that's when the real campaign will start. It's going to be a closed-door campaign among the leaders that they will really decide. But I miss this tension, this war room preparations. I mean, in 2019, in 2014, just to give an idea, what European political parties do is really to set war rooms with people mostly social media savvy, graphic designer, video editors that can really help the online communication on online channels and support the tour that the candidate is doing across the European Union. So the candidate is trying to visit as many countries as possible and doing rallies and giving speeches and meeting people. And so back in Brussels, there is a team, social media team, that can really help that tour. This time around, I'm afraid that there's going to be much less of it. It's going to be much more of a damage control offering from the EPP and from the other political parties. is going to be just a wait and see after the elections.
Yeah, it is kind of ironic that the two kind of main contenders are maybe running subdued campaigns, although, as Eddie noted, Schmidt is certainly trying to get out there. But Clotilde, you've also done reporting on TikTok, and not just influencers, but some lead candidates from maybe parties that may not have the strongest Spitzenkandidat, but are still having really powerful messages and influences online. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
We looked with some of my colleagues at TikTok and how it was being used by different members of the European Parliament. What we found is the far right was particularly active and popular on this platform that's really liked by a lot of young people and that has over 140 million users across the EU. It's in part because these politicians from the far right groups have joined the platform earlier and have shared much more radical messages that get amplified by the algorithm of these platforms and on TikTok in particular. And also they have adopted some of the viral trends. We've seen Jordan Bardella, the leader of the national rally in France, who barely talks about politics and instead memes and shares comments on viral trends and tries to use that to his advantage to appear like just one of the cool kids, basically. You also have those for whom it's not working, because you've seen in Germany with the AfD.
That's the Alternative for Germany, the far right party.
Correct. Yeah. So the leader for the list, Maximilian Kra, was actually sharing conspiracy theory about the great replacement, that far right theory that white people in Europe are being replaced by non-white people. And TikTok eventually took action against him and basically banned his account from being recommended in people's feeds. So the algorithm won't share it until the election because it was not respecting the terms and condition of TikTok. But so we're seeing the far right being very active on these newer platforms where mainstream parties have lagged. And so we've seen just this week, for example, the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz decide to join the platform. But last time I checked, I don't think Ursula von der Leyen was on there.
Not only they are lagging behind, even when they join this platform, they usually communicate in a very conservative way that is not appealing to the young audiences that usually are on this platform, so that makes things even worse.
I also think that if Olaf Scholz and von der Leyen join TikTok, it's going to do nothing to make this campaign more interesting if they just share the same old sort of tired stuff that they put on all the other platforms.
And he's the one who has to track all of that. If you had one wish of something that they would say or weigh in on.
I think there's more potential in this campaign than what we've seen so far. Who knows what could happen? That Schmidt, for example, is someone with a big personality and he likes to show that personality. I don't know if he's been able to kind of get out of that bubble yet. But he certainly is looking extremely enthusiastic. I mean, his acceptance speech in Rome was very passionate. He talked about his father, sort of personal family tragedy.
My grandfather was caught in a crossfire as German soldiers occupying Luxembourg were fighting with French soldiers. Shot in front of my father's eyes in the family kitchen. That experience, dear friends, shaped my family and it shaped my politics too.
He is open and one could imagine a kind of Jeremy Corbyn style moment here. You know, Schmidt might improve his popularity massively. And who knows, at the end of these 2 months, if he has been putting in the work, he may be in for a top job. Probably not European Commission president, but something else.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about how the European campaign is sort of 27 different campaigns. Does that by nature just lead to a situation where the pan-European message is just inherently lowest common denominator and bland? Matteo, is it conceivably possible to have an interesting, flashy, spicy pan-European campaign?
I think it is, if there is the willingness and there are the right candidates in the game. I remember when Jean-Claude Juncker was campaigning as a candidate of the European People's Party. He was visiting countries. His statements, his declarations, sometimes they were in conflict with those of the leaders of the countries he was visiting. This was creating buzz, was creating news. In 2019, Weber saying that he didn't need the votes of the Hungarians, and of Viktor Orban, the prime minister of Hungary, who was just kicked out by the EPP, also create quite a storm. Those elements would definitely fire up a campaign and would definitely fire up a campaign like the one we have now. I still have hope that we have 2 months to go there is the key element that is missing, which is, of course, the fact that 200 million European citizens or more that are going to vote at European elections, they can still not vote, they can still not write the name of von der Leyen on the ballots or Nicola Schmidt, and they still vote for national parties. Mm-hmm. They still don't see the logo of the European political party in the ballot. So that's still a handicap.
Yeah, you're saying that even though we have this idea of a lead candidate system, even though we have these European political parties, voters have to be really informed, actually, to kind of make the connection between, say, von der Leyen and the EPP and Schmidt and the PES, the Party of European Socialists.
I think it's going to be interesting as well to see where does von der Leyen go. I don't think she's going to be visiting all 27 member states. So she's deciding probably a handful of countries that she's going to visit. Is she only going to visit the countries where the EPP are in government?
Yes, she will.
Probably only, right? So, and that would be a shame if she was really kind of campaigning, and as a politician who wanted to gather popular support across Europe, she would go to countries like Spain or where places where the EPP isn't in power and sort of try to convince them, or at least put on a show of trying to convince their voters that, you know, we are the party that should lead Europe.
At the same time, she knows as well that she needs the support of Prime Minister of Spain, Sanchez, and all the other political families, leaders to be re-elected. So that's why she's going to be very careful. I think she joined a fight in a ring, but just moving from a corner to the other to avoid to be punched. And this is not entertaining for us that we are the public, we are the spectators of this fight.
Yeah. Well, as much as we're talking about wishing for a more freewheeling campaign, actually, Clotilde, the parties just agreed earlier this week to some rules to restrain themselves.
They've agreed to this voluntary charter led by the European Commission to play fair offline and online. And I think as a tech journalist, I'm interested in the online part of it. And that's because we're seeing all these new technologies develop, like AI, especially generative AI, the rise of deepfakes that are having an impact on campaigns around the world. We've already seen deepfakes of Joe Biden in Slovakia, in the UK, in France. Actually, the Macron's own party shared a deepfake of Marine Le Pen that was unlabeled. And so that created confusion. So the idea behind this code of conduct that is, again, totally voluntary, so they can do whatever they want in the end. But the idea is to set some ground rules to say we will not use unlabeled deepfakes. We will not heavily micro-target people with manipulative messages. We won't use bots. And that's pretty important, especially because some of these platforms out there like X haven't been great at moderating political content and have cut back in their content moderation teams.
All right. Well, Clotilde, I knew that you have to get to a press conference, so we're going to leave it there. Clotilde, Eddie, Matteo, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that's it for today. We'll be back next week. Until then, make sure you follow EU Confidential on your favorite app. And while you're at it, we'd love it if you could rate and review the podcast. And if you want to get in touch with our team directly, you can email podcast@politico.eu with your opinions and ideas for guests or topics. I'm Sarah Wheaton. Thanks to Christina Gonzalez, Politico's deputy head of audio, and Deanna Sturris, our senior audio producer. See you next week.